Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Hi, this is Dick Staub. Thank you for joining us for Kindling's Fest 2010. Today, our lecture is from Dr. Jeff Kuse, and his topic is iPod, YouTube, We Fit Friendship through the eyes of emerging adults. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Jeff Kuse?
In the late 80s, yeah, there was that long ago, I was working for a large ministry in the Seattle area that also had, as a media relations manager, and they had a couple of radio stations. And as a part of working for this large ministry group, I ended up traveling to a lot of national religious broadcaster conventions and ended up going to the GMA, or the Gospel Music Association, big event in Nashville a couple of times that's coupled with the Dove Awards. And in 1989, I was at a luncheon at the GMA in Nashville, and there were a number of these little luncheons that happened at this event, hosted by different labels trying to promote artists. And this small label that was just getting started, called Reunion Records, was pitching some of their new artists. And a newly signed artist, and one of those artists who was coming on the label was Bob Bennett. And Bob came up, sat on a bar stool, and this is, you know, this is in a big hotel, and people are kind of, you know, getting goodie bags of free stuff, and books are being published and things like that. And people's phones were the size of shoeboxes in those days when they would talk on them. And Bob sat on the stool and played Man of the Tombs. And I'm this, you know, 20-year-old idealized person who thinks that, you know, the CCM, Christian music industry, is really this amazing thing. And I just spent 3 days learning that it was really kind of a scary place. A lot of product being thrown around, a lot of people choosing image over substance. And in the midst of that craziness, there was Bob Bennett. And I can't even tell you how meaningful it is to see you here, and particularly for you stewarding your pain in such an amazing way, in a gifted way. So again, thanks, Bob, for your gifts. I asked Bob, when I saw him, actually I grabbed him by the shoulders and said, would you please do Man of the Tombs before I speak, because Mark 5 is going to be the center point of what we're going to talk about this morning, this encounter with the Gezerine demoniac that Bob mentions, and so accurately, hermeneutically tells us the story of this encounter. Jesus lands on this shore, comes ashore in this land of tombs with this man who's been chained wrist and ankle to the ground, left to die, slashing and cutting himself on stones. And Jesus encounters this man and has this amazing encounter that Bob sang so well. When I think about the generation of adults, young adults that I work with as a professor, and as I've worked with over the years as a campus pastor and now as a faculty member at a couple of different universities, much of the story of the Gezerine demoniac fits their story. And it's probably not a surprise in many ways either, because one of the most iconic teenagers in history that many of them have been forced to read in school also uplifts the Gezerine demoniac. And that would be Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye. Holden Caulfield, as we know, is this iconic character of the beatnik 50s in New York, goes on the run, goes and sows his oats, if we will, as he tries to come of age, the typical cynic, the disenfranchised late teenager. 11th grade English lit classes still require it for many. Some schools burn it, others require it. It depends on where you live. Caulfield is this rebel. And yet he's so iconic, and the book Catching the Rye is so iconic, that many people know it without even having really read it. It just is this thing that represents the rebel youth. Kurt Cobain, the lead singer for Nirvana, had a copy of Catching the Rye in his pocket when he killed himself. Heath Ledger, the actor who just passed away a couple of years ago, famously playing the Joker in The Dark Knight, had a copy at his bedside when he was found dead in his New York City apartment. It is attached to iconic figures in disenfranchised and rebellious teen years. In chapter 14 of Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield climbs into bed and he muses about the Gospels, what he thinks about Jesus and the disciples. And he gives us a really interesting picture because he favors the demoniac over anybody else. He says this: "Finally, though, I got undressed and I got in bed. I felt like praying or something when I was in bed, but I couldn't do it. I can't always pray when I feel like it. In the first place, I'm sort of an atheist. I like Jesus and all, but I don't care too much for the other stuff in the Bible. Take the disciples, for instance. They annoy the hell out of me. If you want to know the truth, they were all right after Jesus was dead and all, but while he was alive, they were about as much use to him as a hole in the head. All they did was kept letting him down all the time. I like almost anybody in the Bible better than the disciples. If you want to know the truth, the guy that I like best in the Bible, next to Jesus, was that lunatic, that one who lived in the tombs and kept cutting himself on stones. I like him 10 times better than the disciples." Millions of teens have read Catcher in the Rye and have encountered the Gezerine demoniac through that lens. When we talk about teens cutting themselves, body piercings, and things like that, this is right in the midst of the world that Jesus was encountering. This valley of the shadow of death that we read together in Psalm 23 is very much alive for Jesus. And Jesus' question that he asked the demon-possessed man is a very telling one when we get into this topic of emerging adults. With potency, Jesus walks up to this man who runs and screams in his face in Mark 5, verse 7. "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, do not torture me." Now, that refrain is something that is in the eyes of many of my students when they come in my class. "What do you want with me, Dr. So-and-so? In God's name, don't torture me." You know, you can almost feel that sense of, what are you going to do to me now? We've been run over, we've been pushed, we've been shoved, we've been sold products up and down backwards. I finally made it here to college, got out of my parents' home. Now what are you going to do to me? Now what are you going to tell me to believe? And Jesus begins this journey that we're going to begin with here today with an unbelievable question, one that Nigel put before us, that we've put before everyone. Asked very simply in verse 9, "What is your name?" He begins the journey of the healing of the demoniac with a very basic question: what is your name? We live in a time when first names are just called that, but there was a time when it was called our Christian name. In Britain, when I was teaching at the University of Glasgow, we had surnames and we had Christian names. Your first name is your christening name, the name that is given you at your christening. When at birth, you know, you're separated to be raised in the faith of Christ, and that name that is given to you christens you into this journey. And yet we have a demoniac who has not have a Christian name, has not been christened yet. And like Holden Caulfield, we also have a generation of students who have yet to be christened, or don't know that they have been in many ways, and so they don't know their true name, what W.B. Yeats calls that face and name that I had before the world was made. And this is the journey that I'll take us on now. And for those looking for outlines and for points to kind of touch base on, kind of touch and goes here, I'm going to take us through 4 movements here in this talk. And so these will be your movements if you want an outline. First, I'm going to define what I mean by emerging adulthood. You know, what is this thing? And this is for those of you who are sociologist geeks, we're going to do some data and also some peer research on that to kind of give you some facts and figures surrounding what we mean by emerging adults here. Then I'm going to move into a short talk about technology and how that plays, and how we've tethered ourselves both as older adults and also emerging adults so firmly with technology that we've become a generation, what I'm calling, along with Shirley Turkle at MIT, tethered selves. So I'll talk about that a bit. Third, I want to talk about why, in order to really do ministry and conversation and friendship around what it means to be emerging adults, much of our conversation needs to be thinking less about postmodernity and more about neo-paganism. More about neo-paganism and not so much about postmodernity. And this is where I am on a constant journey as someone who does a lot of work with postmodern theory in my research. I'm constantly trying to get people away from that. In the church in particular, it's like the church is like Don Quixote fighting windmills oftentimes with postmodernity. People just aren't interested in the discussion anymore. So let's put it to bed, say it was really fun, but now let's move on and talk about what really is what's going on, which is paganism, right? Which is really, and so I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And then I want to give you, the final movement is of this fourfold movement is I want to give you a benediction and a commissioning for how we create friendships with emerging adults, what they're looking for in friendship, and what are three basic moves or shifts that we're seeing there. So if you want to do anything really for the note-taking side, wait to the end. Those three basic movements are my kind of the things I want you to take away. So in those four movements, pick and choose where you want to check in and check out. Check your Twitter feed, update your Facebook status, and off we go. All right, so let's start with emerging adulthood. What do we mean by that? People talk about being a child of the 60s. I actually was a child in the 60s. child of the 60s is a term for many who talk about when they came to their sense of self, right? So that phrase, as we understand sociologically, are usually people in their young adult years, 20 to 30-year-olds in the 60s. I was born in 1965. My initials are JFK. That gives you some indication of where things were flowing. As we move out of the 50s, after World War I, World War II, as America kind of settles into its sense of self as a world power, as sociology begins to shift, we have a new category of adulthood starting to emerge. Two big theorists here, if you want to go back and kind of do bibliographic reading on this, is one is Jeffrey Arnett. And he really kind of framed this book in an Oxford University Press study called Emerging Adulthood. The other is Christian Smith, who teaches at Notre Dame. His two masterworks on this question, one is called Soul Searching, which is the largest research study done on religious tendencies in teenagers in America that's been done. It's a fantastic study. And the second study that was done that gets on emerging adulthood is called Souls in Transition by Christian Smith. And come after me afterwards if you want bibliography and Amazon offers, aplenty. So as they've looked at this study, some things happened after 1950. There was a huge expansion in higher education in the late 20th century. More and more opportunities for people to go off to college as opposed to having to go to work. For many of your parents' generation, college education was a rarity. I know for my grandfather in particular, graduating from college, the first of his generation, was a big deal in the Depression. It was a very rare thing. In many parts of the world, it's still the case. Now, college education is, by and large, fairly ubiquitous. There's many opportunities, many colleges, many online opportunities, many junior colleges as well. As a result of that, the trend after the wars, after the Korean War and the Vietnam War, to delay marriage longer, began to be seen in the eyes of the next generation being born of parents who had delayed that as being normative. And this is one of the things I'm going to keep coming back to. Emerging adults are modeling that which their parents are. Parents still play this role. So they delayed longer, right? Taking longer to make some kind of decisions about what it means to be a grown-up. Part of Jeffrey Arnett's study was talking about looking at how do you know you're an adult now? What are some of the factors that you do? And now the number one thing that will be is if I've had a child, right? So with the rise of contraception, the acceptability amongst Christians in particular to use contraceptive technologies, to make that just absolutely normative and then therefore to wait to have children means that people now wait longer to self-identify themselves as adults. Also what came with this is substantial parental support that went well into the late 20s. One of the things that I think is really interesting in this trend is I get parents who come to SPU and they drop off their students, their bags, they've got their IKEA furniture they're going to put in the dorm room, and they've got the new clothes that are going to be there, and this shiny new laptop that they're going to bring to college with them and all this stuff. And often I'll get a parent, father or mother, kind of pull me aside at one point when they see me and they go, Dr. Cuse, I'm really excited for my sunstroke daughter to come to SPU, and I really hope that, this is going to be a place they can learn about Jesus. And I'm thinking, okay, so you want me to really have, do you really want that? Because, you know, basically what we've got is a guy who ran away from his parents quite a bit in his early years, basically, you know, got his full sense of commissioning in his life when he was in his 30s and spent a lot of his time inviting himself over to other people's houses for dinner. So you may actually get what you wish for with this. Another thing that we have with regard to emerging adulthood is an unbelievable saturation in media culture. And the idea of entertainment. Entertainment portals, ways to actually see and partake of entertainment now, is absolutely ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's on your phones, it's on your iPods, it's on your smartphones. And what happened is the chunking of data now has gotten such a level of sophistication that people send each other clips on a regular basis to get you the most important bits. Case in point. Saturday Night Live, you know, one of the great style makers and culture makers of the 70s and 80s, has now only survived in many ways on platforms like Hulu and YouTube by doing clips, small generated clips that can go viral and hopefully bring people back. They've chunked their show into 3-minute blocks. And students that I know who will watch a clip by Adam Sandberg or others of who are on the current cast of Saturday Night Live don't know the show, they know clips, right? And that has to do with a lot of the cultural saturation of mass media. So this age now that we have arising, and here we're talking about a demographic age of 18 to 29-year-olds, have put off what it means to be an adult longer than many generations have in the past. This means extensive life transitions, identity exploration that seems to continue to go on, transience and a lot of confusion and anxiety because the end point is never really defined. When am I supposed to be done with this? And the permission to constantly continue exploration and actually being told to constantly do this means that I never know when I'm actually there. And this causes many people great anxiety, and particularly if you're a parent, you're probably feeling some of this anxiety as well. Now, emerging adults also, as we've looked at the data sets around this, have a very interesting relationship with religion and how they understand what religion actually is, and particularly Christianity. One thing that's really important to note about 18 to 29-year-olds in America today is religion and Christianity in particular is not a threatening topic. To say that you're a Christian in a group isn't necessarily like something that's like, oh, I don't want to talk to you anymore. There's been a lot of press that basically says, oh, you know what, you know, kids today, 18 to 29-year-olds, don't call 18 to 29-year-olds kids, all right? If you can drive a car that is over a ton in weight at 80 miles an hour and you can also go to war, these are people who we need to start moving as adults as well, is that they do not think of Christianity as a threatening thing. Indifference is more the deal. It's like, okay, well, that's interesting to you, but you got to tell me why it matters. Basically, most people surveyed in this study have seen that religion is for making good people. People go to church and they learn morals. And this is what's really interesting about the study that Christian Smith did about emerging adulthood. Young people coming to church, 18 to 29-year-olds, basically come into a church with a belief that what Christianity is moral therapeutic deism. This is a phrase that Christian Smith framed. Moral therapeutic deism. Morality. I become a Christian because I therefore have a compass point to know what's the difference between good and evil, what's right and wrong, right? And so you have a particular morality, you're going to tell me what that is, and then I'm going to kind of make some decisions based on that, all right? Therapeutic, that basically that all Christianity is to basically tell me about me, okay? So it's all about the pronouns, and this is why we're going to get to the I and the you and the we here in a minute about how much identity is grafted into this in a very particular way. And then this idea of deism. This idea that basically God is somewhere way out there in a galaxy far, far away. The idea of God being present, incarnation, this idea that God makes sense in real time, real life, is something that is very foreign. And the reason why, the number one reason why, is because they don't see their parents believing it. They don't see their parents believing it. In the study that Christian Smith did at the University of North Carolina and then took his researches to Notre Dame was this very basic point. If you want the next generation to adopt the Christian faith, then they have to see parents do something of great risk because of their faith. They have to risk something, and they have to see what that risk looks like. Sell your house and go move somewhere. You know, change your job and go do something in that way. Sacrifice your 401k plan. Stop going to work 80 hours a week and stay home with the kids. These are things that if they see that happen, then they see it's real. But if we talk about it to 18 to 29-year-olds and say, you need to believe this stuff. Oh, I really got to go right now. And then I got to go work, chunder. And I tell my kids, you need to be on the select basketball team. You need to go do this. You need to go do that. What I'm hearing is that's the most valuable thing in the world. Right? Because what you want me to be is a citizen, not necessarily a Christian. And those may be different things. So the religion question, you know, is very interesting. You know, this idea of moral therapeutic deism and how emerging adults kind of view that. So what it comes then is that for emerging adults, many of them have a take it or leave it. They're really actually, yeah, okay, show me. They're kind of the state of Ohio, the show me state. You know, show me that this really makes a difference in your life. How has this thing that you talk about is the most important thing in your life affected your life journey? How has it affected the way you do your career? How has it affected the way that you read books? How has it changed the way you listen to music? Yeah, and it's a show me, not just a tell me. And part of the journey that churches need to embrace with this, and this is getting to a later part of my talk, is we have to move away from a youth ministry focus back to a church focus. That everybody in the same room sharing the stories together becomes an important part of this journey. Okay, so let's transfer out of sociology now, and let's go to the technology question for a second. Pew Research, Pew Research Foundation, in partnership with Harvard, in the Harvard Center for the Study of the Web, in 2008 did a study of 2,000 parents and children. And they wanted to take a look at how American families are using technology, and particularly how emerging adults are using technology. What are they using it for? Okay, so I'm going to give you some percentages here to kind of give you a framing of what's happening with technology. 75% of Americans go online every day. 75% of Americans. So three out of four Americans at some point in some way are online. That's amazing. I mean, think about that. Think about that reality as we sit in that. 94% of American teens ages 12 to 17 use the internet every day. 94%. My kids who are here, they're online at school, you know, in kindergarten, you know, doing programs, right? So this is just the world they swim in. 87% of parents are online. 73% of American households have broadband in their homes, which is, again, a staggering number. Only 6% of teenagers don't have access to internet. They can go to the public library and all these kind of things, right? So we can talk about justice aspect, but that's kind of intense. So what do they do online? What do emerging adults do when they're online? Well, 81% of the usage of the web is to learn about movies, TV shows, music groups, or sports stars. It's basically to look at websites that mirror what is valued. What is valued, right? Walk down your supermarket aisle before your checkout and look at the covers of Cosmopolitan, of Gourmet, of all the magazines that are there. This is the mirror of the world, of what you value, right? And so the students will go online that I have and they'll check out all this stuff because they want to see what's valued, and this is what's valued. 77% will go on to get news clips. 58% of online teens have a profile online. 57% of online teens have created some kind of content online beyond just kind of their identity, meaning a blog, a Twitter feed, something like that. Content generation. Now, this is what's really important as well about this use of technology, is that teens are trying to figure out ways of telling their story. You know, I did my PhD in Victorian literature and theology, right? And so talking about 19th century literature in relation to blogging seems kind of strange, but when you look at the Victorians, they were doing the exact same thing, only the technology was a pen and a piece of paper. Lots of journaling is happening in this space. Now, what is the face of a teen online? What is being seen online? And this is what was really funny. I was talking to the Kindlings 2.0 yesterday at lunch. meaning the children of the Staubs and the children of the Johnsons. And I decided, okay, I'm gonna take the next generation of some of this leadership, and I'm gonna pull them aside. We're gonna eat our salmon. What do you guys think about this topic? What do you think, right? I'm gonna leave that hanging there. Let the parents kind of look at me for a second. One of the things that's important in this conversation, as we were talking about the use of Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, was really interesting, but it mirrored exactly what the research shows. 66% of young adults, emerging adults we've talked about, have some kind of profile online, but they're restricted. They're restricted. Teens, and this is as young as 10 and 12, are not as susceptible to predatory attacks as people think they are. Kids have been raised to be savvy about not letting people talk to them when they're not supposed to. We hear the horror stories in the media, right? The pedophiles and the predatory use of the internet. 77% of teens who have an online profile that is visible have great protection on it, and they will only make it visible to the people that they've actually met in the flesh. So that should give you some confidence. A little bit of confidence here. That's not to deny the horror stories that are out there, and we need protection in this. Now, another part of this that's very interesting, and as I was talking to people about this yesterday, just to get their feedback on this, 56% of emerging adults have fake profiles out there. This is very, very common with my students at college, and I see this a lot as well. Well, they have one Facebook profile that their parents get to join, and then they have a whole other Facebook profile, right? Right? And actually, I have colleagues at the university who do the very same thing, where they will have a Facebook profile as a professor, and they'll allow their students to join that Facebook profile, and then they'll have a Facebook profile over here where they'll talk about how much they love Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because they don't want their students to know what a geek they actually are. Fortunately, I gave that up a long time ago, and everybody knows I'm strange. But this idea of posting different identities on there is also a blessing and a curse in development for emerging adults. It's a way that they're trying to figure out who they are. Back to Jesus' question, the demoniac, what is my name? Who am I? And the multiple ways in which they're doing that, they're trying on different personalities, and they're looking for ways to connect with individuals to do this. One of my favorite writers on this, and another book that I really encourage you if you want to follow this up a little bit more, is Sherry Turkle. She's a clinical psychologist, but also has a background in electrical engineering. She teaches at MIT, and she has an incredible book called Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of Internet. Great book to get if you want to kind of dig into this question deeper. And Turkle says that once we take virtuality seriously, and this is something I'm going to tease out a little bit in a second, once we take out the reality that your identity exists not just in this room, in flesh and blood, but you have given over some of who you are to other spaces. You've compartmentalized some of you. For some who are writers and poets, part of who they are has been bled into the pages of their writing, right? And it's been released from them, and now readers take it up and they use it in a different way. For songwriters, their music is a part of who they are that goes off and does this. For some people, the virtual realm is a way they do that as well. There's a part of who they are that is now stewarded out in the space. And if we take that seriously, Turkle says, we need a new language of talking about the simplest things. Each individual must ask this question. What is the nature of my relationships? What are the limits of my responsibility? Who and what am I in this space? And how do I move towards intimacy? And this is going to get towards my benediction at the end here. Is that what happens in the virtual space as people friend each other and make connections with each other, you know, through Facebook and through Twitter feeds and all that, there is a question of where will this relationship go? Is this really a friend? And we use that term in Facebook language, you know, you friend somebody. Is this somebody really a friend or their acquaintance? And so the term friend in itself has become deeply problematized because of that. Somebody can ask you to be your friend on Facebook, and if you don't want to be their friend, what can you do to them? What's it called? Ignore them, right? You don't just tell them that you don't want to be their friend, you actually can ignore it and pretend like it didn't happen. And what this does is it fosters it pulls us back into the ways that some emerging adults are actually doing their own relationships now in real time. And this is the problem with some of the way the technology has formed people around this. What Turkle says is what's evolved in this, and this is where I want to take you next, is that technology in its many manifold forms has created in us, and particularly in emerging adults, the reality that we are tethered selves. She puts it this way. We are tethered to our always-on communication devices and the people and things that reach out to them. Web pages, voicemail, games, artificial intelligences. The self now attached to its devices occupies a liminal space between the physical and the real lives on screen. It participates in both realms at the same time. Now, I'm going to do this as just kind of a show of hands. How many of you have figured out that you have free Wi-Fi access here at Kindlings Fest? Okay, and when were you told that you had free Wi-Fi access? You just went for it as soon as it was told to you, didn't you? And you had access to it. How many people have used it? Okay. You're on while you're here, aren't you? Right? Turkle goes on to talk about a train station in this way. A train station is no longer a communal space, but a space of a social collection. Tethered selves come together, but they don't necessarily speak to each other. Each person at the station is more likely to have an encounter with someone miles away than with the person in the next chair to them. Each inhabits a private media bubble. Our media signal that we do not want to be disturbed in our conventional sociology with physical proximity has taken on certain hand motions. So you have your phone off, and I'm talking a little louder while I'm staring right at you. And she says, also, you'll get this kind of put my finger in my ear, which tells you now I'm no longer here anymore, but I'm somewhere else. The tethered self always disenfranchises and becomes what Turkle calls electronic co-presence. We are now fully and completely present in different places at the same time. My phone is always on. One person who I'm not going to out here came up and told me, by the way, I need to let you know I'm expecting a phone call during your talk, so don't be offended if I have to get up and leave. And I said, no, that's fine. Actually, that happens all the time now. Students will flip their laptops up. They'll be doing things while I'm talking to them. They'll be engaging devices as they go. Turkle calls this this co-presence a way of kind of mediating who we are in any space and time as an act of control as opposed to an act of intimacy. She says it this way. Business people do email during meetings all the time. Parents do email while talking to their children. Couples do email at dinner in restaurants. People talk on the phone and do their email at the same time. Once done serendipitously, the habit of co-presence has become increasingly normalized in our time. Indeed, being somewhere else electronically than where you are is almost a sense of self-importance. I'm needed elsewhere, so therefore, aren't you glad that I'm here with you? Right? And so that tethered self and that electronic co-presence reality has fostered a way, particularly for emerging adults, to instantiate their identity, which always gives you an exit strategy. If there's something here that's not working out, there's always somewhere else I could go. Someone else who's always there. And the ubiquitous nature of having 2,000 Facebook friends, of having a call list inside your phone that's going to jam up your memory because you have so many, is a way to say I always have an exit strategy. There's always someone else other than you, which means I don't have to put all my eggs in a basket with you necessarily. And that becomes a challenge for intimacy. Now, I want to transition here, and I want to add another layer on this. So we've talked a little bit about kind of sociological data. We've talked a little bit about technology and how that kind of plays with this tethered self idea. And now I want to kind of take a spin on this and add another layer of idea, this move from postmodernism to neopaganism, and then kind of wrap this up to some strategies as we look at how emerging adults do friendships. I am someone who was fostered in graduate programs learning about postmodern theorism and the idea of postmodernity, right? And there was a period of time, particularly coming through evangelicalism, where the mantra was, postmodernism bad. Say that, postmodern bad. You know, so it was this kind of Cro-Magnon sense of you just accept that, you'll be safe. How many of you saw the movie Pleasantville? Saw that movie Pleasantville. There's a great scene in the movie Pleasantville. I'm not going to go into too much of the data behind it, but there's one scene in the movie where there's all this change happening in this town of Pleasantville that's all black and white. And the town doesn't want to change. They want to stay the way things have always been. And so they go hide in the one place that they know will never change. And who knows what that place is called? Well, they go to a bowling alley. and they have a meeting in the bowling alley, and they say, we're going to be safe in the bowling alley because nothing ever changes in the bowling alley. It always remains the same. And postmodernism, you know, is not the problem, I'm going to say. And I hope all the people who want to take me on this rush at me with all their spears. But the postmodernism, as I'm going to particularly state, is a fight for the mind in a particular way, right? Neopaganism is about the whole enchilada. And part of the challenge, I think, for academics like myself, for the church in many ways, is we basically view people as brain with legs. The cerebral cortex coming in and sits in a pew, right? Kind of bouncing there on its little legs, boing, 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 right? And we kind of do doctrine, 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 apologetic, 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 right? Reason, reason, reason at you, right? And then the brain gets a little bit swollen, right? And then it goes out the door, okay? And then we think, that's it. We've done our work, right? And so we write books, and we kind of chunder on this, and we kind of go like this on our arguments and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, we're more than brains. And actually, a lot of things that happen in my life don't fit in this thing called reason. You know, and now I'm not going to disenfranchise reason, because I'm part of the reason industry as an academic, but there's more to life than just my mind. There's a thing called a spirit and a body. And part of the pagan move that we've seen for generations has been about trying to capture what it means to live a whole life and a whole purposeful life. And emerging adults are moving in a huge wave towards a form of neo-paganism and are not terribly interested in postmodern rhetoric. They don't want to fight about that stuff. They're not terribly interested in your argument. You can tell them Jacques Derrida is killing the Bible. A lot of them really don't care. It's not terribly interesting. What they are interested in are the questions that animate your life. What is the thing that you love most and why? What is hate? What is loss? Why do you get up in the morning? That's what you get animated by. And for some reason, a lot of churches and a lot of universities, like, you know, we stop talking about that stuff sometimes. And people get lost in the mix of the names and the phrases. Neopaganism is a move for many that, on one hand, rejects a lot of the consequences of modernity. Secularization. You know, that there has got to be something spiritual going on. The amount of books being sold, you know, by Dr. Phil and Oprah and others who are trying to pull people into a new form of spirituality is at record highs. It's like a tidal wave. People are hungering to say there is more to this life than living and dying. That this is not just a podium, but this is something that it has something about it that is very important. Also, there's a quest to resacralize the world, to kind of find out what is there. And this is why the move towards the arts is so huge in young people. Absolutely hungering for it, to restore mystery to a disenfranchised and burned out world. And many emerging adults are running towards sources where they can find the quest for spirituality articulated through the arts. And this is why a conference like this is absolutely vital. Absolutely vital. My kids right now are hanging out with Kathy Hastings doing art. By the way, nobody's really talked about this, but we need to be giving a big round of applause to the kids program this week. And I want to challenge you at the end of our time, when we go down to lunch, to go down to where the parents run to pick up their kids and go see the stuff they do. There's an art gallery there that's incredible. There's also a real hunger for just kind of moving towards the depth of things and moving beyond just kind of the casualness of relationships. And this is not foreign to the Christian faith, this move, this neo-pagan move. There's a move towards getting to the deep, down, dark things. And Nigel introduced us, you know, to a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. And one of his great poems, God's Grandeur, you know, is very much this hunger to get to the underneath things. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like the shining of shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod. All is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, wears man's smudge, shares man's smell. The soil is bare now. Now can a foot field be shod? For all of this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest, freshest, deep down things. And though the last lights of the black west went out, oh, morning in the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Spirit over the bend, the world brews with warm breast and awe, bright wings. Hopkins writes this as the Industrial Revolution takes its toll in the early 20th century, and people are tearing the earth apart looking for coal and blackening the world with this search. This is what Tolkien was lamenting, and as he reimagined the orcs tearing the earth apart and destroying the nature that was around them. And for many emerging adults, they too are asking the question of green justice, of sustainable gardens, of what does it mean to participate in a world holistically and fully, and want to do that in a powerful way. Well, let me give you some strategies now as I close, and this is just going to be some three movements that I want to do as a benediction and a commissioning for you, and this is my takeaway terms. If you're going to write anything down, this will be the things to write down. First, emerging adults are a generation that needs to move from vulnerability toward intimacy. Vulnerability towards intimacy. One of the downsides of the moralistic, therapeutic, deist movement is this idea that vulnerability is everything. If I'm just exposed enough, I'll find friends, I'll find relationships, I'll find depth of meaning. So I'll post as many pictures as I can to my Facebook profile, and I'll tag you in it so you can see picture after picture after picture. Constantly trying to expose you to these sources of things. Well, vulnerability is not intimacy. I can expose myself, tell you all my deep, dark, dirty secrets, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you and I are in a relationship, does it? Intimacy costs us something. It means I am now staking something in you that is going to cost me everything to be in relationship with you. I'm going to give you a part of myself, not just merely to be vulnerable, but now I'll never get it back because now it's yours. This is the stewardship of my life to you now as an act of friendship. John 15 talks about this intimacy in a powerful way by saying that where Jesus is the vine, we are the what? The branches. We are so intimately entwined with the source of our life that the beginning and end part is non-negotiable. And this is why the question of objective versus subjective may work for philosophers with the Kantian revolution forward, but it's not terribly interesting to the gospel. God is deeply subjective, people. God gets involved. And God is not standing away somewhere just being stiff and not engaged. The incarnation is about as subjective as it gets. God's not indifferent. Christ is not holding off love, waiting for us to get our act together to get to him. We have a God who's pursuing us like the hound of heaven, nipping in our heels. And intimacy is that way, right? So vulnerability moving towards intimacy is one journey. The next journey that many emerging adults need to be introduced to, and which we can help with as well, is the movement from immediacy towards memory. Immediacy towards memory. One of the unfortunate byproducts of technology is the immediate access to information without discernment. The immediate access to information without discernment. I sit and lecture in classes, and then I have students who Google check me every step along the way. No, Dr. Cuse, that's not quite right, right? And I'm sure that when Jerry's quotable Lewis book is on Kindle, we'll be quoting it and checking every Lewis quote that we hear at a conference. We live in a generation that's always spot checking, right? And the pundits and the news sources do this. Did he really say that? Let's make sure he really did. So we always have information checking, but is there discernment? Is there discernment? And one of the ways we learn about discernment is through memory. Because if we learn something and then we sit in it a while to understand its meaning over time, then it becomes something of our own and it also takes on a life that it was meant to take. Jesus is big on memory, right? The gospel points us towards having good memories of reflecting on who Christ is. In the 22nd chapter of Luke's gospel, when Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper, Jesus puts these elements, this technology of bread and cup before them, breaks it apart, deconstructs it, if you will, before their very eyes, have them devour it, and then he says to do the same thing. Go and do this. Tauto poiete ta anamethein in the Greek. And that this tauto poiete in the Greek, poiete is where we get the word poetry, poiesis. Go make poetry in remembrance of me. A lot of churches have basically said, make sure you get it right in remembrance of me. Don't you do it wrong in remembrance of me. You know, and that is not what the gospel is. The gospel is about making poetry. And that poetry then becomes a memory, a recreative moment where we make it our own and move it on to the next generation. Memory is powerful, and we need to create moments of memory with emerging adults so they too can have memories of what this is like. Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament scholar, in an interview in Image Journal, go get Image Journal, awesome journal, go get it, shameless plug. Walter Brueggemann was asked, what do you do with new atheists, this new atheism movement, and how do we help people understand the gospel with this new atheism? And he said, simple. If you think atheism is all it's cracked up to be, then dedicate yourself to 1 year living in community with Christians. At the end of that year, you think that it still holds, fine. Right? Now that's a challenge to us, right? Are we a place that somebody wants to spend a year with, right, if you're a Christian? But I think it's a really good reminder. It's like you create memories that go beyond reasonable arguments, and you live and you flesh yourself with people over time. Is this really the life that somebody's going to want to live? And I think Brueggemann's absolutely right. The third movement. So the first one, vulnerability to intimacy, intimacy towards memory, and the third movement, from choice into chosenness. From choice into chosenness. For many emerging adults, they live in a world where they are told that having choice is power. I was in West Africa in 1987 for 4 months. And one of the things that I acknowledged when I came back to America, first and foremost, was just how much cereal we actually have options of. Do you notice that? You walk into a supermarket, and you can have as many varieties of Cheerios as you want. I mean, who thought that we needed so many options? The choice is amazing, right? Those who have iPods have the choice to always cut in and cut out whenever I want when the song's ever getting boring, right? I can cut and move things around. I can chop things up. I can clip this and put it into there. It's all about the power of choice, and choice is power, right? And that's why consumerism is such a powerful thing, because it gives you an ability to choose to do something. I have control if I can buy it. And that's why debt has become, you know, forget about debt. I just want to be able to buy, because buy is the most important thing. But what about chosenness? As opposed to the ability to choose something, what if I am chosen? What if someone says to me that the most important thing isn't your ability to choose, but you have been chosen? You are one of us. You are in the family. Jesus in Mark 5 asked the question to the demoniac, what is your name? And he says, I am all these voices coming through channels that I cannot stop, right? And we live in a generation of emerging adults who hear multiple voices, thousands of voices a day, coming at them and attacking them with everything that they've got. And Jesus cuts through the noise. Remember what Screwtape called the hell is the kingdom of what? Remember what in Screwtape letters? The kingdom of noise is what he called hell. And it was the kingdom of noise. And Jesus cuts through the kingdom of noise with clarity and disbands those voices into screaming pigs. Jesus sacrifices the economy of an entire town to save one person. Okay? The economy of one town to save one person. And in that chosenness, somebody sits in their life and they'd be given a story to remember, not just an immediate encounter. Because as Bob told us in the song, he wanted to leave and go with Jesus, but he says, no, you need to go tell them in your town what has happened to you. You have been chosen for this. This is who you are. This is your identity. You are a man of flesh and blood, healed, redeemed. Now go tell that story. Be a good steward of your pain and do this work. And so in his chosenness, he goes home, and as we hear in the last part of that pericope of Scripture, and they were all amazed. They were all amazed. So our journey, I want to close with this, is a journey to take these students, these emerging adults, on that journey with us in this. There are a lot of voices. We are tethered selves with conflicting voices in them. Some of those voices are very good and very powerful. The ability now to say and do things on the internet is amazing. But we also live in a generation where everything is amazing, but not very many people are happy. And so as we move that journey with them, let's take these three movements of vulnerability to intimacy, immediacy into memory, and choice into chosenness as our commission today. So I'm going to leave you with that, and we'll call it good. Amen.
You've been listening to a special podcast originating from Kindlings Fest 2010 on Orcas Island. For more information about the Kindlings, go to www.thekindlings.com.